This is Pet Life Radio. Let's talk pets.
And we are live. We are live here on Instagram and on Pet Life Radio. I'm waving as you come in. Hello, all. First of all, happy Sunday. And those of you who are still celebrating Passover, hope it's going well. Anyway, here for you, here for your pets. And anything you want to know, now's the time to ask. Very easy to get a hold of me. Well, if you're on Pet Life Radio, just join us. Same thing on Instagram. Just go ahead and ask away. I want questions. I have good stuff to talk about, but really want questions. And so get me the old-fashioned way. You can always get me toll-free 877-385-8882. Once again, 877-385-8882. And whatever you want to talk about, that is good. While we're sitting here, you know, it's interesting. I was reading something on the AVMA, but it's called Smart Brief. And there were two stories back to back. And it's sort of ethical, philosophical kind of stuff. And would love to hear what you think. My role is a veterinarian, our role. So here's the story. It's a Massachusetts court is considering a case where a woman kept a sick dog alive against the advice of her veterinarian. Apparently, 15-year-old dog or 14-year-old dog had a large tumor, and the dog was starting to suffer, and the veterinarian recommended euthanasia. And he felt and explained to this woman that that dog is really suffering. So what happened then is she refused service. She refused to do anything. And it got reported. Now, I don't know whether the veterinarian reported it or someone else reported it, maybe one of the technicians, staff. Now the courts are considering, do we accuse this woman of animal cruelty, whether it's a fine or she's sentenced for whatever it is? Because I know in certain states, animal cruelty is now a federal offense. So anyway, it's interesting. Then the very next story coming from Tennessee was a new bill allowing veterinarians to report cases of cruelty against people, most likely a client or a pet they've seen. And it's something that will not violate the VCPR, the Veterinary Client Patient Relationship confidentiality rules. So we have a certain kind of, it's almost like a HIPAA rule that in people, there's a certain confidentiality that we have to maintain with our clients, our patients. And if we report this to a state board, is that going to affect the confidentiality? And their Tennessee is now saying, you know what? No, we should do it. So what do you think? Are we wrong as veterinarians not to report such cases? Now, let me also tell you one case that happened, well, with me, to me, back in the day when I had my own practice down in Culver City, an area that at the time was not as what it is today. I mean, it was not Beverly Hills. Let's put it that way. So now it's hopping. Now it's great. I'm glad I bought my real estate back then, because now it's really great. But I would see a lot of these people that were fighting their pit bulls. And a pit bull would come in. Of course, it would never happen. They're not going to admit that they were fighting. But, you know, a dog would come in literally mauled, and they wanted me to fix them up. And I knew what was going on. And then the fear of repercussion, because these are not the element of people that you want fighting against you. Let's put it that way. I had a brand new building, a lot of glass. And there's always concerns for my staff saying, yeah, you can't. You just got to. And I played hardball with the guys. I said, look, I don't give a damn what you're telling me. I know what's going on. You do not want to do this. It's not fair. It's not right for the dog. I tried to give my spiel. But if I had turned the police onto them, the only person they knew who knew, it's me. So it's like, what do you do? At what point do you worry about the safety of your staff, of yourself, of your building, et cetera? So anyway, I am curious to know. I mean, what do you think? Do we jeopardize? Do we not jeopardize? Do we make an anonymous phone call, which clearly won't be so anonymous because these guys know the only person that knew was me. So anyway, what do you think? So a Goffin's cockatoo not burn candles in the house because of him. Well, there are certain fumes. Now, for example, when it comes to the citizen birds, you do not want to have them in the kitchen if you are going to be cooking with any kind of a nonstick surface like a Teflon. They're definitely emits certain fumes that are toxic to birds. So I'm not saying regular candles. It depends on, is there a scent in the candle? And what is that? An overall blanket saying no candles in the birds. That is not correct. But there are certain fumes, certain elements, when heated, do emit a fume that can be very toxic to birds. So I know that, again, you know, as you know, I don't treat birds regularly, but that was something that stuck with me. Don't cook with Teflon or nonstick coated surfaces in the kitchen when a bird's in the kitchen. So if you're going to cook, take the bird out of the kitchen. As far as the other candles, I'll certainly ask around, but I don't think there's a blanket rule like it is with cookware when it comes to candles. But that's a great question. All right. If a dog's ears are dirty, that does not indicate an ear infection. It absolutely does not indicate an ear infection. I get, interestingly, certain breeds, and as I know, because a lot of the doodles will have some, they have a lot of hair in their ears. What's the one thing that they get from their poodle ancestry is they grow hair in their ears. When there's a lot of hair growing in the ears, it does interfere with the air flow in between, you know, coming from the outside to the inside of the ear. Remember, dogs and cats' ears, especially dogs, are at a major disadvantage just based on their anatomy. So when you have a vertical canal that then makes a bend into a short horizontal canal, it's not like ours. Ours are just a short horizontal canal. You could take that Q-tip and you could pop an eardrum in no time. But with dogs, yeah, that's why if you never see dog Q-tips, your veterinarian uses, they're these long things because you need to get down deep into the ear canal. So hair does not help. I am an advocate. I know some disagree. I'm an advocate of gently and routinely plucking hair. Some of the ones that are opposed is they say, well, it leaves the ear inflamed, et cetera. I think that's technique. I think it's how you do it. I have never had that problem. And there's an art to plucking hair. You don't want to take that whole clump and do it all at once. It's sort of like you're just teasing it. And I prefer not using instruments, just trying with your fingers. The problem with the instruments is, which is usually just a hemostat, a Kelly, a mosquito forcep, is that you sometimes, if you're not careful, and if you don't exactly know what you're doing, you end up pinching some of the ear tissue itself. That for sure is going to lead to problems. And that's why when I speak to certain ear docs, some dermatologists do ears, they say that's the problem. So that's why they say don't pull the hair. I disagree. I think that if it's done properly, then and it should be done. So I get many dogs coming in that have a quote unquote ear infection because they see a little bit of a discharge. And it's not a mucousy, light-colored bacterial discharge. It's not that dark, waxy yeast discharge. It is just, ears get dirty, just like people. And because of their anatomy, they're going to get dirtier, and it's sometimes harder to see. So routine ear cleaning is a recommendation. There's so many products out there. Of course, mine, I think, is the best. Hear You Now. No, but there are a lot of products out there. But Performance by Dr. Jeff has Hear You Now. And that works really well. But the best thing to do is stay on top of it. And by doing so, by keeping the ears clean on a regular basis, you will probably help prevent or at least minimize some of the ear infections. So anyway, keep that in mind. Good question. I just did a post on Wilfred, another Vanderpump Dogs Rescue. You know, one thing I have to say, what I really like about Vanderpump is that they go in out for the downtrodden. They will go get these dogs out of the shelter that nobody else wants. They're either, this dog was 15 years old, had the worst teeth on the planet. I had to pull 13 teeth. He was not neutered and he had a testicular issue. One of his testicles was noticeably smaller. That could mean something like a Sertoli cell tumor. So I therefore was happily, we checked the dog out, lungs were, you know, clean, blood taste came back great, and we anesthetized him, did the dentistry, did the neuter, 13 teeth, rotting teeth. And I got to tell you, you know, I know he's going to feel better. I even think he felt better by the time he went home. It was that fast. That dog must have been in so much discomfort because of those terrible teeth. So anyway, he's doing great. So for a 4-pound dog, you know, they usually say it's about 10 mls per pound per day. You know, you could probably give more if he's dehydrated. If you do 40 mls a day, you start with 20. Now, also the reason is why you're giving sub-Q fluids. Is it just because of dehydration, because of weakness? Is he not drinking enough? Is it kidney? I need to know what's going on. But if it's just pure dehydration and you're sort of getting him his strength back, give him about 40 mls a day, that would be fine. I usually just take his weight, multiply by 10. And sometimes if he's dehydrated, I'll multiply that by another 50%. So if it's 40 plus 20 is 60 ml per day if he's dehydrated. But go slow. And also, because he's so small at 4 pounds, don't do it all in one spot. maybe two or three different spots. Make sure your needles are clean. And anyway, oh, and also, I've seen people do this when they do sub-Q, and even my own technicians sometimes do it. Don't take the bag and squeeze it, forcing the fluids to go in faster. I'll tell you why. When you're subcutaneous, the fluids will follow their own path of least resistance as they're being injected into the body. When you squeeze the bag like that and force the fluid in, it in a sense is separate. It's tearing the attachments of the skin to the subcutis. And that, I think, when dogs really object or they're sore after getting fluids, they shouldn't be. But when that happens, I usually see it's because the fluid was forced in. So let it come in naturally. It's going to take a little longer. It's okay. And I just think it's nicer for the dog. All right. When we travel, we better help prep with the suitcases come out. Well, that is so, isn't that funny? We used to have a little rat terrier. Our name was Millie. And when the suitcases came out, she was in the suitcases. She says, no, you're taking me with you. You're not getting to go by yourselves. There's no way. Something that happens, see, I hear it all the time. And now the association is there. Suitcases mean I'm going to be left alone. Now it's time to start peeing on the bed and peeing in shoes, peeing in the suitcase. So cats really let you know they are not happy. They are not happy with being you going away and not taking them with you. So there's no magic. You can't. I mean, maybe shower them with affection, sort of make life really great for them when you're gone, whoever's going to be taking care of them, leave them with some really goodies. Look, as I say this all the time, I would rather deal with the most difficult cat medical or surgical problem over a cat behavior problem anytime, because they're tough and they have their attitudes and they have their ways about doing things. And when that's going to be disrupted, they have no problem letting you know. So anyway, don't go away. We'll be back after these messages. When you come back, bring me some good questions. Otherwise, we've got some more stuff to talk about, and we'll be back after these short messages. Don't go away.
Take a bite out of your competition. Advertise your business with an ad in Pet Life Radio podcasts and radio shows. There is no other pet-related media that is as large and reaches more pet parents and pet lovers than Pet Life Radio. With over 7 million monthly listeners, Pet Life Radio podcasts are available on all major podcast platforms. And our live radio stream goes out to over 250 million subscribers on iHeartRadio, Odyssey, TuneIn, and other streaming apps. For more information on how you can advertise on the number one pet podcast and radio network, visit PetLifeRadio.com/advertise today.
Let's talk pets.
Let's talk pets.
On Pet Life Radio.
Pet Life Radio.
PetLifeRadio.com.
And we're back here. We're back to the some suggestions about where to give the sub-Q fluids. And this has subcutaneous fluids. The neck, shoulder area, there's a lot of loose skin. And on the side where like the love handles would be, that's also a place where there's a lot of loose skin. The key is you want to tent up the skin. So now you make it like a little tent, all right? And then you don't want to put the needle in this way where you're pinching up or down. You want to split the difference where the skin is kind of curving up like this. And that's where you're going to go 45 degrees right there in the center. And there's let it rip, open up the little thing on the fluids. If you are in a good spot and you're sitting there holding the fluids up, the skin up, those fluids should go in pretty easily. It hurts when something doesn't. Yeah, that's like anything. I can give shots and I'm pretty good at giving shots. And most of the time with the technique, I kind of pinch the skin, move it around a little bit. First, I tap with my finger, then split the needle. They don't seem to respond. And sometimes they do. You know, and I'm sure this is just not my dentist, but when the dentist is putting the Novocaine, first of all, don't look at that needle. It's really long. It's going to freak you out. But they got that big syringe with the big loop around the thumb. And all of a sudden, he starts jiggling your upper lip. That's because it's sort of, I don't know, it takes some of that sharp point away when he actually sticks it in. And once it's in, it's really not a big deal. So it's an art. You get better at it and you will. Okay. 5-year-old COVID adopted cat who got used to us always being around. She hates when we travel and notices when we suitcase come out. Any tips to support her? We just talked about that. This is not uncommon. We see it a lot. With us, it's more the dogs than the cats, but they know. So again, the cat sitter is great. Feel away is great. have the cat sitter come in, spend a little more time. It's just one of those things. And it's a cat. Cats have their own way of responding to influences and things that they're not happy at. Dogs sometimes sulk. Cats, when they're not happy with you or what you're doing or how you're doing it, they let you know in other ways. I go back way back to a friend of ours that was dating a guy. And we met him once or twice, unimpressed. That means we were unimpressed. But she liked him, whatever. But she had two cats. Every time this guy would take his shoes off in her house, the cats would poop in his shoes. Now, if that wasn't enough to tell our friend, this guy is not right. Sure enough, she ultimately found that out. But it was interesting how the cats knew way before she did that this guy was trouble. All right. Vets recommended my dog have blood GI panel. He's having lots of stomach issues. Is this worth it? So that's a really good question. And this really boils down to a number of things. My feeling is there's no GI panel for blood. Now, no direct, I should say. Now, will the blood let us know about the liver function and kidney and pancreas? All right. These are the extra abdominal organs that all are linked in some way to the intestine. And so the answer to that is yes. But this is where I'm different. Sorry. I would want to see the dog. If the dog is, except for the diarrhea or whatever the GI issue is 100% happy, is eating, is running, is playing, everything else is normal, then my first thought is it is not going to let us know anything on the blood test. Now, because of that, we tried all the other things that I would do first. Let's modify diet. Let's maybe try a probiotic. Add some fiber to the diet. All those things that we do to try to reestablish a normal gut flora, gut balance. And if that doesn't take care of it, then I would resort to the blood work. So it all really depends. Now, if, however, the dog was also ADR, that's very scientifically for ain't doing right, and was having diarrhea, then I would do blood tests. Yes, something's going on. But otherwise, it's probably not going to show up in the blood. So I would try other things first. That's just me. As I said, I am not an academic vet. There's no way. I am a practical vet. That was, I think, from my education. We had a professor who used to give us these tests called latent images. Ask us questions and give all sorts of choices of what to do next. And then you had a pen. It was like, looked like a highlighter pen. It was kind of something like a highlighter, but it wasn't. When you put it over the area where the answer was, then the answer would appear. That's why I called it a latent image. And then the answer would be like, you just wasted $40 of your client's money. Or that's a very good test to run, but it's not going to help you in this case. I mean, he had really cute, funny answers to get you to start thinking. It's all about evaluation, thinking. You really need to think about all the options. And then instead of having on your list of differentials, having 10 things, after you really do some thorough analysis, get a good physical, good questions to the owner, really evaluate the pet itself and the history. How did it start? When did it start? You could rule out over half of your potential possibilities right there. So then you're left with two things or three things to test for. And no one does that anymore. You come in and all I want to do is run tests. So as I said, I have a slide when I speak. I'm not impressed by a veterinarian who can run every test in the book and give me a right answer. I am, however, impressed with a veterinarian who can't run every test in the book, but still gives you the right answer. That is what it means to really evaluate a case. So I'm a fan of that. All right. Dehydration from pneumonia. Absolutely. That's what it is. Okay. So I'm hoping that he's also having the medication for pneumonia. But I'm saying we're seeing a lot of pneumonias now. Remember that influenza, that new virus, that we're seeing a lot of cases. So of the canine infectious respiratory disease complex, trying to figure out the correct spot to inject to not hurt. Around the neck, his shoulders is good. The flanks are good. You know, just maybe pinch the skin first, maybe tap it with your finger first. And really, once you're better at it, you're going to be able to stick that needle right in. I think the hesitation part is where you're kind of afraid to stick them. So you don't want to stick them hard. I get it. But you'll get better with it. I promise. So you're right. She's just, I knew it. They're so predictable, those cats. Let's see. Can I explain? I got another question. Floating kneecaps. Of course. When you have a floating kneecap, first of all, without even knowing your pet, I will tell you that the likelihood, if I were to guess on the odds, I would say it's a small breed dog. And can it happen in larger dogs or medium size? Yes, it's usually the small guys. It's the Yorkies, it's the Palms, it's the Maltese, it's the little poodles. They have what's called MPL, medial patella luxations. So the patella itself, the kneecap, I'm going to try to not to get too technical. So Beth, if you just know, don't yell at me yet. So it sits on a groove. All right, called the patellar femoral groove. It sits right there. And that's what the Groove looks like. It's got two high ends and a center, a deep center. Now, on many dogs, it's more like this. One center is high, but the other side is very low, so that kneecap keeps slipping off medially to the inside. All right? So, four grades. Grade one, the kneecap is usually in the groove. I can pop it off with my thumbs, but as soon as I let go, it pops right back in. Don't worry about it. Not surgical. Grade two, it's usually in the groove. I could pop it out. When I pop it out, it stays out for a while. But the dog usually, if you notice, sometimes they'll hop, hop, they'll straighten their leg, it pops back in, and they're running again. That's grade two. Surgery, questionable. Depends how old the dog is. I would take an x-ray. If it's an older dog and no arthritis, then obviously it's not that bad. And unless the dog is limping a lot, I leave those alone. Grade three, it's out. It's sitting here all the time. I could move it back in, but all it wants to do is pop out again. That's a grade three. That's usually surgical. Grade four, 100% surgical, is where it's out so long, it forms what's called a false joint, and you cannot reduce it, meaning you can't put it back in the groove no matter how hard you try. That's surgical. So three and four, I would talk to your veterinarian about surgery. And those are the ones that usually you're going to see some hopping and limping. Now, what happens when it's bilateral, meaning both sides? Then you may not notice it because it's both sides. Again, your veterinarian should check this anyway. Take x-rays. If there is any joint disease, arthritis, I probably would recommend having a surgery done. Different kinds of surgeries to do. Make sure your veterinarian either has done many and knows how to do a tibial tuberosity transposition. You have to realign the quadriceps muscle group, which leads into the patellar tendon, and then from the patella to the insertion on the tibial tuberosity of the tibia, that's the patellar ligament. You need to straighten that out, because if it's going medially, as it usually does, it's going to keep popping that kneecap off. So the veterinarian just makes sure they've done it and they're comfortable with doing the tuberosity transplant. All right. New York Yankee, for an old dog getting gabapentin, what is the most milligrams you would prescribe? My 6-year-old is now on 100 milligrams of gabapentin a day. It all depends on how much he weighs. So if it's a 16-year-old dog, you know, 10 pounds, 15 pounds or more, 100 probably is okay. If they're really small or they're not tolerating it well, then I would go under. There's a liquid gabapentin, 250 milligram per 5 ml, which is 50 milligram per ml. That's great for exact measurements. Big dogs, usually I do 300. If it's a really giant breed, I might give 600. Obviously, it goes by weight. So that's what I'd recommend. Boy, a lot of you guys love it. I love it. Do you recommend a brand of toothpaste to brush dog teeth? I don't really recommend a particular brand. There's so many out there. And interestingly, many of the other brands are made. It's like going to Costco. You think they make all that stuff themselves? Kirkland? No, they buy it from other companies. So it's the same thing. I would find a toothpaste. All pet toothpaste are non-sudsing. They are swallowable, because if you could teach a dog to spit it out, I'd be impressed. Can you teach me how to do it? Because I can't. And they taste good. They're usually flavored, poultry flavored, shrimp flavor, beef flavor. So you're looking for something like that. And use it. Start with a small amount, but there are many, many brands out there. 18 pounds. Oh, for 18 pounds, yeah, 100 is fine, as long as he's tolerating it. So we got the floating kneecaps. The correct term is MPL, medial patella luxation. All right. So unless we have any more questions or comments, I want to throw one more thing at you just to think about. Maybe, you know, I always say it's okay to make a mistake. We're not perfect. We're all going to make mistakes, but learn from it. And there are certain things that kind of hit me that I know that, oh, I've seen that before. I'm not going to make that mistake again. And, you know, I wish we could say we're all perfect. It ain't going to happen. So here is something to learn from others. I get a call from one of my clients who is adopting a new pet. They're getting a dog from a breeder. She, funny, when she told me that, she apologized before I said anything. She goes, I know, I shouldn't have gone for a breeder, but we went to the show. There was nothing that struck them. They want a particular kind of dog. Anyway, so she calls me to say the dog is at the trainer now, and it was just diagnosed with parvo. I go, how old is this dog? 9 weeks. Whoa, wait. You took him to a trainer? She goes, no, I didn't. The breeder that gives a shot, an 8-week shot, then sends it straight to the breeder for 2 weeks. Are you nuts? That breeder is nuts. This is why getting dogs from breeders is not always a great idea. So I'm going to give you some guidelines. First of all, you do not take an 8-week-old puppy, even after one shot. Remember, this particular puppy may not have made any response whatsoever to a shot. Let me tell you another mistake breeders make all the time that really, I don't know a nice way to say it, so I'm not going to say it nice, pisses me off. And that is, I see these records coming from breeders. Now, if you're a breeder What is the assumption? If you weren't working, you know, we shouldn't assume. I know that makes an ass of you and me, but you would think that they were nursing well from mom for at least the first 24 to 36 hours. That colostrum from mom is good for minimum 6 weeks, usually up to 8 or even 9 weeks. But if you give shots at 5 weeks or even at six, all right, you are basically neutralizing mom's passive immunity. You are using it up because that immunity is going to see the antigen from the vaccine. It's a vaccine. It looks exactly like the real disease. So they're going to attack it. So it's going to minimize mom's protective immunity. And it's going to no good for the puppy at all. Because at 6 weeks, 5 weeks, six, puppy's not ready to mount its own immune response. So you're leaving this pup with nothing. So then 8 weeks is when we should start. You start at 7 weeks. I can live with it. I prefer eight. You don't want to go more than four in between. The ideal, if you want to start at eight, finish at 16, because by 16 weeks, 98% of the dogs can mount their own immune response. So, and you don't want to wait more than 4 weeks in between. So 8, 12, 16, the perfect schedule. But to start at eight and immediately send it to a trainer who obviously has had other dogs. So of the two litter mates that she sent there, both ended up with parvo. Duh. So I said, don't you dare take that dog. If this dog is sent to a trainer after just 8 weeks of age, first of all, what could you teach an eight-week-old dog? That's like training an infant, right, to learn math. I mean, it's way too early. They're not going to retain anything. Socialization. That's all it's good for. Do that at home. So anyway, long story short, she found another place, another breeder, had that greatest dog. But I have found when you are thinking of getting a well-bred dog from a breeder, you need to ask the following questions. First of all, when's the first vaccine given? Okay. If it was given at 5 or 6 weeks, wrong. And who is your veterinarian? If they can't literally say, oh, I go to Dr. So-and-so in this hospital, well, we give our own shots. No. Don't trust them, because breeders, when they become breeders, they think they get a DVM degree along with it. They don't. That means a veterinary degree. In fact, I have seen the most horrendous, ridiculous vaccine schedules every 2 weeks, 6, 8, 12. And then when I try to call and talk to the breeder, very nicely say, hi, I'm Dr. Jeff Werber, I'm a veterinarian in LA. You know, I noticed the vaccine schedule. There's a lot of new things we've learned over the years about vaccines. And this is what we should do. And I give it, and I get something like this. Look, Sonny, I've been here doing this for 40 years. I think I know what I'm doing by now. And you don't know what you're doing. So be hard-headed. If you're going to get a bred dog, you want to make sure the vaccine schedule is up to date, correct, minimizing any exposure to dogs they don't know going to a trainer. How dumb. And making sure that they know right off the bat their veterinarian, who they go to, whether had the veterinarian seen these dogs, et cetera, et cetera. If the answer is no, move on. All right. Anyway, that's my words of the wise, from the wise. All right. We'll see you next week. Same bat time, same bat channel here on Pet Life Radio. If you have any questions during the week, you know how to get a hold of me on Instagram. Find me Instagram Live. Just send me a text here on Pet Life Radio. Dr. Jeff at PetLifeRadio.com, and save your questions or send it to me for it. If you have a really good question, I'll share it with everybody else on the show, because I guarantee that if it's really something that's happened to you or your pet, obviously, then it's happened to others as well. And maybe we can all learn from whatever it was that happened. All right. See you next week. Bye-bye.
Let's Talk Pets every week on demand, only on PetLifeRadio.com.